You are part of the Critical Engineering Working Group. Before we talk about that, another question, what is the status quo of the current engineering world? If there was a manifesto for engineers at companies like Apple, Google, Facebook or Amazon, what would the manifesto say or stand for?
Yes, it's a very interesting question, really. One of the dominant definitions of engineering is that it's a collection of technical disciplines in service to science and industry. So it's a second, sort of substrate or a layer of knowledge that's only ever in service to a higher power of industry and science. And that almost eradicates any possibility of it having a engineering as such, that collection of disciplines and cultures, and ideas, and in fact even ideologies. It erases them from having any kind of consolidated manifesto of their own, you might say, because they're in service. Even though they're in service, there are a lot of assumptions in the different disciplines of engineering that themselves show biases and start to look a little bit quasi-religious after a while, but that's another thing. I think that engineering is, as I was saying a little bit earlier, engineering is now so transformative in the level of human culture, society, even the landscape. I mean, you're looking at the impact that of a flat bridge that had over the movement of genetic material. People could cross a river that you could never cross. Languages could mix and change. Fruit could move across, and markets could cross pollinate. Different races could interact with others. That's on one level. Then you start looking at the ships and aircrafts. I mean, what has EasyJet done for multiculturalism, for instance, here in Europe? I mean, that's just on a surface level. But anyway, its reach is so deep that. If you're going to have a critical conversation about it, it needs to be decoupled or detached, if you like, from a service to science and industry. It needs to be something that we can all talk about, just as we do already politics. I think people have a stronger grasp of the basics of politics here in Europe than they do engineering in general. Children can tell you more about the solar system and about what a flower is made of than they can about how email works, or what the internet is. And these are examples, I think, of the bigger problem. Engineering needs to not be that boring thing that's what boring people do when they work for science and the scientists and for big industry, and actually start looking around us and thinking, what am I dependent on, and what would change here if this wasn't here all of a sudden? If the lights went off and the refrigerator doesn't work, or we all had to switch back to writing letters, thought experiments. Mm.
So that would mean to be a critical engineer?
Indeed, yeah. That's how we put it anyway. It was initially a provocation in one sense, but primarily it was conceived by Gordon, Daniel and myself as a means of reframing our own individual practices away from the term Medienkünstler, we wanted to, which is so broad, and also we often get called hackers, even though we never call ourselves hackers, and I've never ever called myself a hacker. Now you can apparently be a hacker if you can hack buildings, or you can food hack, you can hack furniture. I mean, now suddenly anyone can sort of, that term has also become very, very sort of abstract and diluted. And so we just wanted to say, no, what we are really interested in all of our work is this thing called engineering and black boxes and opening up closed systems and exposing them for study and conversation, and when we understand how to manipulate technology, we can understand how it can be used to manipulate us and so on and so forth. And most of the people doing that are just locked up in industries, working for Google and Amazon and the like, or Boeing, General Dynamics, big companies, pharmaceutical industries, just the same. people on the outside that are reaching in to the stuff around them. You know, we talked before about smartphones and, you know, how you can, you know, how they're effectively an ear and an eye into your life in so many different ways from outside. Break open smartphones, you know, get in there and reverse engineer and find out what's going on.
So I could imagine that a Google engineer also would say, I want to make the world a better place and I want that people have a better life and so on. So is maybe the difference between you and a Google technique, for example, that you want to make a technique also transparent, that everybody is able to use and develop it by themselves?
Definitely. Raising the public conversation, raising the vocabulary and the conceptual grasp or, you know, understanding as to how all this stuff works is very important. And we do that with workshops. We do a lot of teaching. Daniel and I, for instance, are traveling generally a couple of weeks a month, and one of those weeks is generally spent doing workshop intensives. We've taught politicians, we've taught you know, young people, we've taught people that come from anthropology backgrounds, and, you know, it's important to us that there's no existing skill set or understanding, that we bring people from zero to knowledge. And while the Google employee could say, right, I'm just developing tools and services that make it easier for people to live their lives, he or she might actually be thinking that they are in fact performing a service, but they're performing a service within a predestined frame and a set of assumptions that he or she cannot break out of, can't take the risk of breaking out of, can't be truly exploratory without actually even threatening their employment position or just making things that are contrary to the interests of the company. And so I think that while it's great to hear, you know, people inside corporations, you know, believing that they're making a difference, it is also important to understand that whatever context you're working in, it has a particular frame. And in that case, for a Google employee, it would be the American jurisdictional system. We are using tools and technologies, especially in a network context, that are authored and controlled by companies paying taxes, well, at least hopefully, within a jurisdiction under which we do not elect, you know. There's absolutely no way that anyone in America would, for instance, to think that there was a Malaysian company responsible for the operating systems on their phones and on their computers. They would say, no, it's impossible. We can't trust the Malaysians, you know. But there's a reason. Google, Amazon. And I've actually heard this firsthand regarding Google. They employ a massive amount of behavioral and cognitive psychologists. Only one in every four behavioral and cognitive psychologists that graduates in the Western world at the moment ends up in therapy, and ends up in health. The rest all end up in advertising and these big companies. And so, yeah, there's a lot of people working really hard to make sure we feel super good about these mega corporations. As I said to myself once when I was in a hotel, looking out over in Hong Kong, looking out over all these lights and skyscrapers, and looked out and I put my phone next to my bed, and I looked out and I said to myself, all of these beds with phones next to heads, you know, we're all doing this thing. We go to bed and put the phone next to, you know, and that's amazingly intimate. You know, that's a deep reach right into the home. You know. Anyway,
in the manifesto, it says the critical engineer looks to the history of art, architecture, activism, philosophy, and invention, and finds exemplary works of critical engineering strategies, ideas and agendas from these disciplines will be adapted, repurposed and deployed. Has there ever been an era in the past that is comparable to our current fast evolving tech era?
I've thought about this a few times, and I'm relatively undecided. I would say that there were certainly times in the classical era where revolutions, if you like, in something like geometry, and when it changed the way that maps were made and area and space were understood. I mean, the Ptolemaic map, for instance, Ptolemy, he changed the way that the Greeks thought about themselves in the universe. I mean, just being able to, even though he was looking at the constellations of stars and using them to make his measurements, that was a mistake because the light was passing through the atmosphere and getting bent, so his measurements were off. But he worked out that the Earth had a circumference, that there was obviously a curvature, that distributions of area and shape, you know, this changed a lot the reality of the ancient Greeks at that time, because just previously they believed that all of the Earth was a disk with themselves at the center, and they saw that was absolutely true, because when they looked out, the horizon was curved. They didn't see it as curving down; they saw it as curving around them, you know, with Athens conveniently in the middle of the universe, you know, which would have given them a lot of confidence, I'm sure. So that was an example of a technical innovation that changed the way people see the universe. And of course, then it all went into hell, really, with the Dark Ages, and we lost touch with that. But there were these accelerated periods, you know. Now you're looking at the impact, for instance, of digital storage media, like from USB sticks to hard disks to the so-called cloud, which is a ridiculous and infantilizing term, I think, but patronizing term, and that are changing the way that we remember. They're changing the way that we see the world and actually even relate to ourselves and to others, you know. Social networking, of course, and the like. I remember when I was in Auckland, I was with my girlfriend, my then girlfriend, when I saw my first mobile phone outside of a film, and it was a guy in a shop. I was there with my girlfriend at the time. She was just buying some cigarette papers. And a guy walks into the shop, talking on this massive black brick, you know. And he was in a bad sort of grey suit, and he was clearly performing. It felt like, at least, you know, the sort of techno elitism, you know, of himself being this advanced sort of, you know, new breed of technologically empowered people. And then the phone rang. And the shop owner, my girlfriend and I, and another customer just burst out laughing, and he ran out of the shop with a really red face, you know. And I said to myself then, there's no way I'm getting one of those things. And fellow New Zealanders were also saying, oh, there's no way, you know, no way. But then gradually, sure enough, the logic changed. And everyone started wanting these things. And then it felt like society had people, you'd hear that everywhere. Where are you? Where are you? You know, New Zealanders traditionally reserve the right to not tell anyone where they are. I mean, it's quite common that you say, I'm going bush, I'm just disappearing, you know, and you don't hear from someone in a week. It's normal, it's fine. Especially in the country area like where I grew up in. And then suddenly to see Kiwis with that anxiety of where are you, where are you? That changed for me the way that I saw New Zealand society. You know, I was disappointed. Sure enough, I joined them and got one of these bloody phones.
Kommen wir zum Schluss nochmal zurück in die Gegenwart mit einem Beispiel. Wie würde eine Datenbrille, ein Smartphone oder eine Drohne aussehen, wenn sie von einem Critical Engineer entworfen worden wäre? Let's come back to the present, maybe with an example. What would a smart glass, a smartphone or a drone look like if it was invented by a critical engineer?
Good, excellent question. Well, for one thing, all of the specifications and the code that runs on those devices would be freely and openly available for public inspection, modification and redistribution. That would be for sure. Like, for instance, the GNU Linux operating system, upon which much of the internet entirely depends. Of course, Google and Amazon all depend on Linux as well. But it would be imperative, it would be extremely important that there was a public ownership over that technology. It wasn't owned by a single organization or group. That's important. And secondly, it would probably report its rather than hiding behind a user interface that likes to simplify things, it would report or encourage at least contact with a bit more of the technical inner workings of that device. That would all be pushed to the function of using the device, you would learn a little bit. And that's certainly how it was for me when back in 98 I really got into Linux, for instance, and it was a university, you know. And I mean, I know I'm not necessarily your so-called average person, which is a terrible term, I suppose. But I'm very curious and interested in technical things. But nonetheless, what I have found is that when I've been teaching people that have had no contact with programming or engineering of any sort, the moment you show them something like the console, the command line, they get really curious. It's always the same. I've even had teachers in universities tell me, oh, they don't want to learn that. They want to make games for the iPad, you know, or something like this. And then it's just not the case. Again and again, people say, this is the first time I feel like I've actually ever seen what's going on under the skin of the computer, you know. You show people how to catch wireless traffic and see the images that that other people are browsing, you know, around you, and people get extremely excited. I can't think of a single person that hasn't got excited when I've said what we're going to learn tomorrow is how to use your laptop to view in real time the images that other people are viewing on open wireless networks around you. You know, people get excited, and there is a curiosity in so many of us that is in fact suppressed by generalistic generalized interfaces that are made by people in other countries, I might add. They're not localized. I mean, hundreds of millions of people waking up in the morning and looking at file, edit, view, you know, desktop, these paradigms. But it's about allowing a little bit more of what's happening underneath to come into the foreground encourages and encourages people to learn, but also inspires that very, very basic curiosity that is kept actively away from us. The last thing many of these companies want, these big corporations, is for you to learn their tricks.